We'll proceed to the third case, United States v. Vincent. Mr. Hillebrand.
Thank you, Your Honor. It's nice not to be first up because then you can get a feel of what goes before you. I am here today representing a lawyer since disbarred before his trial who represented himself, and I am court-appointed on his appeal. The major issue, I think, the substantive issue here is whether or not the trial judge should have granted a continuance. And both the government's brief and the briefs that I submitted, I think, are very thorough in setting out the arguments and the factors, and I won't reiterate all of that, except I'd like to emphasize a couple of things. There are three reasons that the government says that my client had enough time to prepare. He failed to use his discovery time. Well, the long and the short of it is that he couldn't see and he couldn't read. The next argument was, well, he's representing himself and he knows the facts. These facts come out of a title insurance business that he was operating on the side of a very busy law practice, so he didn't know the facts. He was really in the same position if some lawyer he had hired was representing him. And, of course, we had thousands of documents. The government's witness, Ms. Donahoe, who did a very capable job, spent 3 years on preparing this case. And she examined thousands of checks, and she admitted that 20 to 30 files would take all day. And yet, given the eye problems and everything, the district judge on this basis refused to give a 60-day continuance. And as a result, I don't believe my client had enough time to prepare the case, and we laid out the factors in our brief, and I would hope that you would consider those. The second issue that I would like to briefly address, in light of what I've heard from the prior two cases, is the Booker situation. Here we have a defendant who was sentenced on the basis of a number of enhancements based upon facts that the district judge found, and of course we all know that this is clear error, and the issue is whether or not the third and fourth factors apply. Obviously, when the mandatory guidelines provide for about a two-year sentence in excess of the facts found by the jury under the Nance case, that this is something that substantially affected the defendant. As far as public perception and all of that, I would like to offer this. I've practiced law for a long time, maybe longer than I care to say, but it seemed to me that the guidelines have been very frustrating to district judges because, in many respects, the guidelines, as they used to be, converted these district judges into bureaucrats. And only within a narrow range could they consider the factors that are generally laid out in Section 353A of the Criminal Code. And in all fairness, judges should be able to consider some of these things. My client, and this affects his preparation time too, during the period developed a severe problem with alcoholism. That came up in sentencing. The judge couldn't consider it. It also affected his ability to remember and prepare. And so, in summary, I think that the public expects judges to use good judgment, and that's why the fourth factor here would counsel that cases like this should be remanded for resentencing. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Hillebrand. Mr. Miller. This is a prestigious day for the Central District. We have the U.S. Attorney and we have the Federal Defender. It's court is honored by the luminaries of the system in the Central District.
Well, thank you, Your Honor. It's an honor to be here. May it please the Court, Mr. Hildebrand. My name is Jan Miller. I'm the United States Attorney for the Central District of Illinois. And I will tell the Court that my argument this morning will be much different and much briefer than I expected it to be when I walked in this morning. Being number 52
That's why I said that number. I know all the lawyers are sitting out here.
Well, Judge Evans is known for chilling arguments.
I consider myself chilled, Your Honor. Addressing first the issue of the continuance that Mr. Hildebrand brought up, I think the biggest problem that the defendant has in this case in dealing with this issue is the lack of prejudice that he has shown. We make the point in our brief that at the time we filed our brief, it was over a year and a half since the trial had ended, and he had yet to come up with detailed cross-examination that he could have done, but he didn't have time to prepare for. Even going back before that, because of a variety of delays, the trial ended in December of 2002. He wasn't sentenced until August of 2003, so he had 9 months.
What was the issue in this trial? There was like $500,000 missing. Was it that? Was the issue, was the money missing or wasn't it, or it was missing and somebody else took it?
The issue was clearly not whether the money was missing or not. There was no issue about that. ATG, when they took over, did actually a very good job tracing all the money, and the loss was fairly clear. The issue that Mr. Vincent raised primarily in his defense was
a co-employee claimed that did some embezzling.
Yeah, he never came out and said who that co-employee was. He had said that to some of the officials of ATG, and he never named a name. At the trial, what he tried to show through his own testimony and cross-examination was, number one, that he was an alcoholic and spent a large part of the time drunk, and therefore didn't really know what was going on in his business, and this was really more a product of sloppy business practices as opposed to fraud. That was obviously rejected by the jury, and in fact, at the sentencing hearing, the judge also found, as to some of the specifics that he testified about, that he committed perjury during the course of the trial, such as when he denied that he was the one who sent an email, an inculpatory email to the president of ATG, essentially admitting that he had embezzled money. So that was the factual issue that the case was primarily based on. So not only did he I'll say one other thing about the continuance issue. Not only in the 9 months between trial and sentencing did he never come up with anything to the trial court, any specifics as to what he could have done with the additional 30 days. I would also point to, I believe it's at pages A88 to 90 of the supplemental appendix in this case, and that's one of the orders that the court issued. And in his motion for a continuance, one of the things that Mr. Vincent wanted were these backup tapes regarding his business. And as we said in our papers, we provided the tapes as soon as we got copies of them. But what it shows at pages A88 to 90 in the joint appendix is, even after those tapes were provided to Mr. Vincent, he then had problems accessing the information because of the software that was needed. We went out and got a copy of the proprietary software from ATG so that he could access it. We set up a computer for him in the courthouse because we couldn't give ATG's proprietary software directly to him. We set up the computer for him in the courthouse with a room. We arranged for a computer expert to help him through that software if he needed it. He never availed himself of that either. So you have a situation where, in spite of the protestations on the part of the defendant, he's given opportunity after opportunity after opportunity to fully prepare in the way he said he was not allowed to, but he never takes advantage of those opportunities. So on this record, it's impossible to find that he was prejudiced by the denial of his second motion to continue. I suppose we're in a situation where everything about Booker that has been said, that needs to be said, has been said, but perhaps not everybody who needs to say it has said it. But I'll try to just stick to a couple of points. I've listened to certainly not all 49 arguments that have preceded me, but about half of them. And there are a couple of things that I haven't heard. I might have missed them in the other 25 arguments or so I didn't listen to, but let me hit a couple of points. Regarding the suggestion that there should be some sort of limited remand, along lines of certifying a question to determine if the district judge would have done anything differently. I think there are a couple of problems with that. First of all, as I think was alluded to earlier this morning, it's really impossible at this point in time for the district judge to give an accurate response to that answer, because the information the district judge would have had at the sentencing hearing post-Booker would probably be very different than what he had pre-Booker. It's very possible that the defendant would have put on additional information that he didn't bother putting on because he knew it wouldn't have risen to the level that would have justified a departure. It's possible that if he did put on that information, the government might have withheld countervailing information it didn't bother putting on because it wouldn't have made a difference. So the sentencing hearing that would take place today might look very different. And so I think no matter how diligent a district court would be, it's really impossible for them to give an accurate response to a limited-type remand.
Yeah, Mr. Miller, but what if both sides agreed that it wouldn't be a whole lot different, it's just that we're in a new era, mm-hmm. so that it would just be basically argument? I mean, would there be a category of cases where that might be the case, where the limited remand, I mean, would give still an opportunity for expansion of evidence if necessary, but let's say mm-hmm. the U.S. attorney and defense counsel are of a mind that what went was adequate, there's really nothing to add, but perhaps just argument on the new advisory role.
I think that I would like to be able to stand up here before the court, quite frankly, and say here's the common ground that I think we can get to. But I think that remanding in a plain error situation opens up a dangerous precedent, quite frankly. I know it's been done before, but I'm not sure that the propriety of it has really ever been questioned. And I'd like to point the court to some language from U.S. v. Vonn, V-O-N-N, which is at 535 U.S. 55, a 2002 Supreme Court case. And in that case, this is certainly not the holding of the court, the Supreme Court there, but they do discuss the propriety of remanding in a plain error situation, in fact, both in harmless error and plain error. And from the government's point of view, what the Supreme Court, and this is at page 68, what they said is the following. Under the former, meaning harmless error, the government's opportunity and burden is to show the error harmless based on the entire record before the reviewing court. Under the plain error rule, the government likewise points to parts of the record to conduct any ostensible showing of prejudice the defendant may make. Under either rule, the government's opportunity is to persuade with what it has not to initiate further litigation. And that is in the context of discussing the propriety of remanding. And I think that's an appropriate observation, because as the court's aware, the whole remand rule, 52B, is a policy decision. I mean, it could be the policy choice to be made that, look, if it's not objected to below, you just can't raise it at all. But defendants are given a limited opportunity to raise it. Obviously, the policy decision is we should require litigants to make the objection at the time so that the record is made below at the time, not with 20/20 hindsight, etc. And I think once you get into the plain error area and you say, well, in some plain error cases, we're going to go back and let the defendant, or whichever side, now recreate the record that should have been created the first time around, you're undermining a large chunk of the policy that the entire plain error standard rests on.
Not to say Booker is situation wouldn't occur again, but would you say that approach could be allowed by the Supreme Court language in Booker and Fanfan? I mean, be permitted. And two, couldn't we say, you know, once we swallow this situation,
that it's sui generis?
Recognizes that, yeah, right, that it's sui generis, that we haven't brought real destruction to the plain error doctrine.
As to the court's first question, I don't think that there's anything that prohibits the court from doing that from the language of Booker. I don't think it's addressed one way or the other in
right.
Booker. As I said, Vonn seems to indicate that they wouldn't be in favor of that sort of thing, but it hasn't been addressed directly. It's tempting to say that this is a different situation, and that's a sense I've gotten from listening to a lot of the arguments, that there's a feeling that this is different because it's arrived through something of a different path. This isn't a situation where a defendant made a tactical decision not to raise it. This isn't a situation where counsel can be called negligent for not raising it. And so I think there's a feeling that out of fundamental fairness, we should find a different path here. But in this issue, as with every other issue, what appears to be fundamentally fair sometimes depends on what position you're sitting in. In my case, for example, certainly from Mr. Vincent's point of view, and I think from every defendant's point of view, what would seem fair would be send it back and let the judge do what he or she would do with the discretion they now know they have. From the victim's point of view, like from Mrs. Simpson's point of view, who is one of the individual victims in my case, I can tell you that the sense of fairness for Mrs. Simpson would be this man should not be allowed an opportunity, even an opportunity, to get a lower sentence, because he was sentenced under a guideline system that was in place for 20 years and that can't be called unjust
on its face.
Well,
he might get a higher sentence, too.
I'm sorry?
Mrs. Simpson would be happy, then.
Mrs. Simpson probably would be happy. Certainly Mr. Vincent wouldn't be, and I think that's another problem that comes up once you go down the remand road. So I don't think it's prohibited from the language, but I don't know that we can say this is not going to open up a kettle of fish.
Well, as expected, Mr. Miller, you have represented the Department of Justice in this position in fine fashion.
Thank you, Your Honor. All right. If there are no further questions, I have nothing else.
Mr. Hildebrand.
Thank you.
Mr. Miller, who, through my experience, I tell the court that he's a very ethical and forthcoming lawyer, and it's been a privilege to deal with his office. The first time I've ever done it, of course, was this case being from Wisconsin. And I'm sure that he did what he thought was right and fair. He mentioned the backup tape situation. These backup tapes were tapes of, as I understand it, title insurance transactions out of ATG. But the guts of this case is thousands of checks. And where did the money come and where did the money go? The backup tapes were one facet of the evidence, but as I say, this was a check case. This was a very fact-intensive document case. It was not a witness case. And someone would have had to properly prepare this case by looking at all these checks, and the fact of the matter is Mr. Vincent did not have the time to do it.
Did he have this alcohol problem throughout?
I think that he developed it in the mid-90s.
Relative to this trial?
I think he had stopped drinking it by the time of the trial, but what happened here with the alcoholism is that the trial occurred, I think, in 2002, and the fraudulent conduct occurred from 1996 to 1999, according to the indictment, and that's when he was drinking. And people who drink can't remember what they're doing and what they say. That's common experience. So the fact that he was sober during the trial wasn't necessarily helpful to him because he was doing a lot of drinking during the events in question. Again, thank you, Your Honors. It's always a privilege to appear before this court.
Good to see you again, Mr. Hildebrand. Our thanks to both counsel. And Mr. Hildebrand, again, a special thanks to you for accepting this appointment, ably representing Mr. Vincent.
Thank you.
All right. Case taken under advisement. The court will proceed to the